11th.
Welcome to your Senate Committee on Rules. We have sort of an unusual agenda here today. We are going to be hearing a few bills, but we are also hearing some executive appointments. And then we have a couple of memorials, and we're trying to accommodate both folks' travel schedule, as well as we have a number of folks that are from out of town. So what I would like to do first, and I appreciate the courtesy from the legislators in the room, is to bring up two folks that traveled from Myrtle Creek and Union on the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and we'll bring you up and grill you first. And that way the rest of the witnesses will be easy, and then we can get you on the road and get you home safe and sound before the traffic. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission and invite Mr. Sconce, am I saying that right, and Mr. Wood to come on up. I know you're having fun with the good Senator Trow, but you can stay and visit later. So welcome. Thanks for joining us. If you both would just tell us a little bit about yourselves and why you would like to serve on this particular commission, we'd really appreciate it. So, and we also appreciate you traveling so far to be with us today.
Thank you. Chair Brown and committee members, my name is Robert Sconce. I'm a chemistry teacher in Roseburg at the high school there. I've been with them for 14 years, and TSPC is one of the boards that we deal with quite a bit, but yet we really don't know a whole lot of what they do. We submit the paperwork every few years. We get our licensure from them. And I'm interested to seeing kind of behind the scenes what goes on with that commission and actually help assist them with policy making with them.
Great. Sarah.
Chair Brown and Senators, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Michael Wood. I'm the superintendent and elementary school principal at Union, Oregon. I've been with the district for 23 years and been in education for 27 years. And the last 15 years have been both the elementary principal and the school superintendent. It's a complicated process to put teaching staffs together in small rural schools, and I feel that licensure is a key piece to that, and learning the ins and outs and flexibilities and rigidities and where they might be. So I feel that with my experience in public schools, particularly rural schools, a placement on the TSPC commission would be beneficial both to my staff, my kids, and my school district.
Thank you.
I stand ready to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Well, you're going to get the first one, Mr. Wood. And could you tell us how you sort of juggle the duties of superintendent and principal, and do you also teach classes as well?
Well, there are two things. One is you need to have a balanced budget that keeps your superintendent job alive. And number two, you need to be available for every small child in your elementary school. And so I supervise lunch duties, run the title program, and Band-Aid things. I mean, I've changed messy pants, and I've not logged on before. You can't wait for a janitor when you only have two janitors in your entire district, so you just learn to do instead of looking for someone else to point to.
Yeah. And Mr. Wood, how many children do you have in your elementary school?
We have about 246, but when you cut the kindergarten in half, it's about 230.
Thank you. My stepchildren grew up in the Enterprise School District, so I'm somewhat familiar of the challenges these smaller districts face. Yeah. Sarah Nelson?
Just happy that you're here today. You made the trip. I appreciate it very much.
I wouldn't have missed it.
Yeah.
Other questions? We're not going to let you off the hook. Could you tell us what's going on in Roseburg? And you said you've been teaching chemistry for 14 years?
I've been teaching for the district for 14 years. I've had chemistry for about the last five.
Okay. And what did you teach before chemistry?
I was one of the ninth grade teachers at one of the middle schools, and we transitioned all our ninth grade kids up to the high school staff about 3 years ago.
Okay. Great. You still have your hands full.
We do.
And are we doing enough to get enough young people interested in chemistry and moving them on into similar fields?
Actually, at Roseburg, it's the largest elective course that we've got. We actually have two staff members that are assigned to it. Most of the others, we've got one or a half FTE. But we're extremely large. We're pushing 2,000 students on the campus.
Wow, that's amazing. Great. Any other questions for these two? We really appreciate your willingness to take time out of your busy schedule to join us, and also, and you're welcome to stay. I just didn't know what your travel plans were, but you're certainly welcome to stay. But we certainly will appreciate your willingness to serve on this particular commission. It's critically important in terms of our education system.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
I need to try to make it back to Milton Freewater by 3:30.
Okay. I think you're in big trouble unless you can find an org. Okay, unless you can find an Oregon State police officer escort, and we haven't funded them yet, so you might be in trouble. So, all right. Thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission and open a work session on Senate Bill 30. Ms. Taylor, would you tell us a little bit about what we've got? And Senator Walker, Senator Westland, come on forward.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson, go ahead.
Madam Chair, before any discussion of this bill or possible amendments, I wish to declare a potential conflict of interest. My family has continuously owned 160 acres at the headwaters of the Matolius River since 1904. In the 1960s, my parents, realizing they could no longer protect the headwaters by themselves, donated land and a scenic easement to the federal government in trade for moving a road away from the river. I follow in the family tradition of stewardship for this unique and special river. With that statement, Madam Chair, I declare a potential conflict.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Ms. Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Senate Bill 30A that you have before you prohibits setting of destination resort within 3 miles of the Matolius River Basin unless the county finds siting will not have a significant impact on specified elements. You have the Dash 13 amendment from Senator Westland, which has other regulations, and also the Dash A15 amendment.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. The Dash 15 amendments, A15 amendments, are mine, and those are legislative findings. And those are legislative findings based on information I received in the many hearings that I held on this matter, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is my bill file on Senate Bill 30. So I just want you to know we've received a tremendous amount of information, emails. Of course, some of the emails were just simply, I love the Matolius, you need to save it, which is all well and good. But what I also needed to hear were some reasons why this area needed protection. I will tell you that I chaired the work group. Senator Westland attended with me. We had two work groups, about 8 hours total of those two work groups. We had some consensus only in the sense that we decided where we could compromise, but there was no consensus from the work group on these two developer proposals. So what I did was draft those final last best offers from the two developers and brought them to my committee on the 26th of April, which was the last day my committee would meet before we closed down for all Senate bills. Those amendments and all the other amendments that were at the hearing there were only two votes for every set of amendments, and I would have needed to be the deciding vote on any set of amendments, which was an uncomfortable position for me to be in. I wanted the committee to come to some agreement. They could not, so we pushed the bill out with the Dash 6 amendments, which pretty much codified Goal 5 and Goal 8, land use goals, in the statute and took out made the most relevant parts and put it in the statute to keep the bill moving. I was content to continue to move the bill in that condition across the Senate floor over to the House while I continued to work with the parties. I will represent that I did work with the Ponderosa development, the larger development, and asked them to come back with a further proposal. They came back with a proposal that I did not find satisfactory.
essentially would have supersided a forest conservation community, as they called it, and it was inappropriate. I was out of time. I could not continue. I did not engage in further settlement negotiations with the smaller parcel because it was clear that was the most upsetting to most of the people who were involved in the discussion about the Metolius Basin. So, Madam Chair, given that we couldn't come to an agreement, I felt it best to lay out in statute the reason why people felt so strongly that the Metolius Basin needed to be protected, and the A15 are those legislative findings. They are not whereas clauses. Whereas clauses we debated on the floor ad nauseum yesterday. Those do not go in statute. I felt that it was important if we were going to close off the Metolius Basin to development, which is what the Dash 13 Amendment does, that we needed to lay out in statute findings as to why this was important. And many of the findings you see in the A15s, I created, and they came from documentation and exhibits in my files. This is documentation. Much of this is fact. And so I felt it necessary to lay out those findings. And that is what you have before you today. I'll just, for your own edification, I learned many, many things in this work group and working this bill. I do a lot of detailed research. I've read the zoning ordinances from the county. And all of this matters on appeal at LUBA. And I also, I just learned a great deal. And so just for your own edification, an anadromous fish, because you will find that in point four, an anadromous fish, and I even learned how to pronounce it correctly, are fishes that spend all or part of their adult life in salt water and return to freshwater streams and rivers to spawn. So other than that, I think everything else there in the A15s are pretty self-explanatory. If you'd like me to further expand on why these findings are here and where they come from, I can do that.
Thank you. Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27. And I would like to begin by sincerely thanking Chairperson Walker for, A, keeping this bill alive and getting it to this point, and secondly, by indeed enhancing it with a superb citing of legislative findings. I would also like to echo Chair Walker's comments with regard to the voluminous public testimony, the very extensive committee process this bill has been through to date, with regard to the process and the deliberations on a most significant issue, and that is protecting one of the most unique and special places in all of Oregon, indeed of all of America, from development by destination resorts. What you have before you, proffered by me, the A13s with a convenient map on the back, is the actual geographic description of the area in which destination resorts would be prohibited. What these amendments functionally do is reduce that area. They pull in the exclusion area from 3 miles outside of the basin to functionally mirror almost the entire basin's geographic outlines, with the exception of a piece on the what I would call the southeast portion of the basin, where the geographic prohibition is enlarged to take in the large development mentioned earlier by Senator Walker. Question might arise as well: if the shaded area there represents the basin, why, Senator, are you going outside of that basin? And while the basin is descriptive, the shaded area is descriptive of the surface water of this area, what is most significant and most key to these protections is the hydrology of the water under the basin. At this juncture, we or no one knows the impacts of future and in reality very large developments in what amounts to industrial forest grounds. So with that, Madam Chair, I would proffer the dash 13s as a in keeping with the true spirit and original intention of Senate Bill 30, and again thank my chair on this issue for keeping this bill alive and getting it to the point where we are today.
Thank you. And by your testimony, I assume that the both of you jointly want the adoption of the A-13s and the A-15th. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker, you mentioned that you had spent over 8 hours in terms of work grouping. Can you give us a just approximate sense of committee hearings on this bill?
We had one public hearing initially that went approximately 2 hours, and then the second public hearing was an evening hearing on the 26th, and that started at 6 p.m. and went until about 9:30, I would think. People at the first public hearing, not all of those signed up got to testify because we ran out of time. But there was no one who was left without the opportunity to testify at the second public hearing. And everyone who attended and anyone after was encouraged to email or send in their comments, which many did. And I reviewed all of those comments, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I spent several hours reviewing the comments. I also went over and visited the Metolius. I'd never been there before. Mm-hmm. I felt it was important to do that. I saw it both from the air and from the ground. Because I needed to understand what this area looked like that we were talking about. And I can tell you, Madam Chair, I've probably spent more hours studying all the material on this bill than any other bill I've had this session, and I've had some pretty complex bills. And I was trying to find a balance here between private property rights and the rights of the county to make decisions, and also the rights of Oregonians to preserve a place that they felt was really important to them. It became clear in the conversation and the evidence that we generated and was generated to me that the biggest impediment to development in that basin is the geologic features, basically the water features. There's real no clear understanding of where all that water comes from, when the final straw might be put into the volcanic rock that sucks the rest of the water out. I know that some of the springs have gone dry already, and there's concern that a large development would continue to take water out of those springs. So, and the Warm Springs Tribe participated. We had quite a number of people who participated in the work group. We had environmental-minded folks. The county council was there representing the county. We had representatives from both of the developments. There were a number of people. I don't believe anyone felt that their interest was not represented in the work group. And I have to tell you, I tried very hard, Madam Chair, to reach some agreement, and we could not.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Walker. And I think Mr. Sconce and Mr. Wood, who we heard from earlier, would have been delighted to have had you in both their elementary classes and their high school classes. Questions from the committee? Senator Montes Anderson.
I'm looking at the Dash 15 amendments, and it's purely a description of the Metolius River Basin. And you feel that that is necessary to have in statute the description, and tell me why.
Madam Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, I believe it's necessary to make these legislative findings because we are closing off the area to resort development. I believe we need to indicate why, and I think having this in statute clearly indicates that it is of a high priority to Oregonians, and I just felt it was necessary. And as I indicated, many of these findings are factual findings.
Sarah Nelson.
Thank you. And along the same lines, in Section 3, Metolius' unique hydrological and geological features cannot be adequately protected through current mitigation practice, and groundwater pumping will likely result in this diminished recharge. I mean, that's sort of a supposition, I think, will likely. And that's not a fact. It doesn't say it will or will not. It just says will likely. And that bothers me, I guess. And the second part, on Section 9, you have protections against resort development. in other significant and noteworthy areas nationally recognized always exist in statute. But then in 11, we have from urban and suburban and similar forms of a matter of utmost importance to protections. Does this change the local land use process in any way? Or, I mean, how do all those things come together?
Thank you. You want to answer first?
Yeah.
Because I have an answer to the water thing.
Well, I was going to answer the water. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson. I have in front of me a letter that was entered into the record from the United States Department of the Interior, U.S. Geological Survey, Oregon Water Science Center, from Marshall Gannett, hydrologist, and Senator Westland had asked several questions. And in this letter, it says here, and I drew that section 3 specifically right out of his letter. In the Metolius River Basin, groundwater pumping most likely will result in diminished discharge at principal spring complexes that occur at the head of the Metolius. This man is a scientifically trained gentleman in the science of hydrology, and therefore I put that scientific fact in the statute.
And if I could follow up on that, the mitigation question I think is a key question. And this is a headwaters that flows out of the ground. There's numerous ways to mitigate, other freestanding rivers whose primary function or primary flow is stream-fed, surface water-fed. But there's no way you can mitigate the flow of a headwater that is spring-fed. I mean, the only way to do it is take the water out of the ground and then pump it back into the ground. That's a key question.
Does it impact the land use process?
Yeah.
Okay. And then Senator Nelson's last question, I think, was does it impact the land use process?
Oh, yes. I believe it does, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson. It takes away the right of the county to decide what they want to do with that land. The county mapped this area, mapped two locations within the basin area for zoning for destination resorts. It only mapped them. It hasn't sited them yet. And it mapped those two locations that are already owned by folks who have ownership of the property and want to develop it as a destination resort. The mapping is what has been appealed to LUBA, and this would basically moot the appeal because it would say that you can no longer cite it for a destination resort in those areas, and that would take it away from the county to make that decision.
Other questions, Senator Farioli?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we not, if this proceeds, do we not create a Measure 37 claim?
Madam Chair and Senator Farioli, no, we do not.
And
because the property is cited currently as forest.
It's industrial forest land, and when it was purchased, there was no mapping, no permitted ability to cite a resort or use it for any other purpose other than what it was zoned for, and certainly not a destination resort.
And, Madam Chair and Senator Farioli, I will follow up with that because I did ask the county specifically on May 8th what this property is zoned as, and it is zoned as forest management, and the permitted uses are listed in their ordinance for zone forest management, and a destination resort is not included in forest management.
What was the nature of the decision that the county made was to make these properties eligible through mapping, through development as resorts? So I would suggest, Madam Chair, that there is in fact a property right that's been created there, and in fact we are creating a Measure 37 claim. And based on that theory, I would also say that there will be a significant fiscal impact to the local jurisdiction if this claim is overturned. If this claim is made and the authority to develop the destination resorts, which was conferred by the county through its mapping activity, is overturned, it's going to be a huge impact on the value of the property. And because it'll be a decision that's overturned at the local level, I think what we're doing is handing the county an unfunded mandate. I would gather that, Madam Chairman, there would be a fairly significant legal wrangle over some of this stuff, and if it isn't at issue, In another venue, it certainly, I think, will be an issue on a Measure 37 claim.
Thank you. Senator Walker, would you like to respond?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. I did communicate and consult with an attorney about that issue, Senator Farioli. Measure 37 provides that a property owner has a Measure 37 claim if the government adopts a land use regulation that restricts the use of the owner's property in a way that reduces the property's fair market value. If the owner has a valid claim, then the government must pay the owner the amount of the reduction in value. The government can avoid making the payment, however, by waiving the land use regulation, as we've seen, to allow the owner to put the property to a use to which the owner could have put the property at the time the owner acquired the property. Ponderosa acquired the property prior to the time Jefferson County mapped it as eligible for a destination resort. So as far as can be determined, Ponderosa and likewise the Dutch Pacific property did not transfer the property to any other properties following the county's adoption of the comprehensive plan. So therefore, a Measure 37 claim does not apply because at the time they owned the land, it was zoned forest management. And that, of course, is one lawyer's opinion. And as we saw at my hearing, we had two lawyers come up and give us differing opinions. You could set 10 lawyers in a room, and they would all disagree. So,
Senator Walker, remember who you're in front of.
Madam Chair, I say that in all due respect, simply because, as you know, I was a court reporter and an officer of the court for 24 years. I have just seen many different takes, and that's why we have judges who make decisions.
Oh, okay. Senator Farioli, and they're unfunded. Yes, Senator Nelson, that is correct. And
there you go.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
It always amuses me when people say with all due respect, because then they've insulted you twice, ma'am.
You know what, Senator Farioli, I hate to tell you this, but I'm used to it at this point in my life. So.
Well, I think that the good senator points out something that should be self-evident to everybody that works in the building. You got conflicted attorneys, you got conflicted opinions. That's why we have the courts. But the bottom line is that we won't really know until this is litigated, and at the other end of the litigation process, we may in fact have stuck the county with a huge bill, which eventually comes due here. Or we may have stuck the state in a situation where it's going to have to fork over the foregone value. And exactly what you described, Senator, as a taking is what we're doing here. So I think this could actually be, if not a direct Measure 37 impact on the property in question, it will certainly become a poster child in any future considerations of 37.
Thank you. Senator, anything else? Anything else? Okay, we're in work session. The chair would move the Dash 15 amendments to Senate Bill 30. Any discussion? Krista, would you please call the roll?
Senator Farioli?
No.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Senator Mons Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
No.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Chair would move the Dash 13 amendments to Senate Bill 30. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll, Krista?
Senator Farioli?
No.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Senator Mons Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
No.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor, move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Krista, would you please call the roll?
Senator Farioli?
No.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Senator Mons-Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
No.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Senator Westland, we'd appreciate it if you would carry the bill on the Senate floor. Senator Johnson.
As Senator Walker and Senator Westland depart, I just would like to publicly recognize Senator Walker's formidable work ethic and heroic efforts while working on this bill. She and Senator Westland have gone to extraordinary lengths to understand and advance the bill.
Thank you very much. And I know that Legislative Council was called in today to assist us in getting amendments completed, and we really appreciate their extra efforts to make sure that we had language correct. So
I do want to acknowledge that, Madam Chair, and I do also want to acknowledge all the parties who participated in the work group, and we just couldn't get there, and this is where we're at, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. This is only the first chamber. There is, I know we like to forget that, but there is another chamber. So,
Madam Chair, as long as the committee and members are being thanked, I would like to thank you for moving the issue up to the top of the work agenda today so that I could participate in the hearing.
We wanted to make sure you are kept in, you know, the good graces of your wife.
Thank you.
With that, and it's a full legislative effort, Senator Farrioli. If you need some additional help, let us know. With that, we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 30. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1035. Senator Gordley, is it NAMI? Mr. NAMI? NAMI. It's phonetic, right? Okay. I flunked phonetics, and I'm not sure they taught it when I was in school.
I was going to say that came later.
Watch it. That's fine, no problem. Do whatever you need to do. All right, Senator Gordley.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Avel Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Multnomah County. And before you, you have Senate Bill 1035, which is related to workplace bullying. Madam Chair, I want to thank you for rescuing and hearing this bill, which was first introduced in the House last session, did not receive a hearing, and then introduced again this session at the request of two of my constituents, Cal Robertson and Odessa Hendricks, two prominent civic leaders in the Portland community. Both of these women have experienced bullying in the workplace. The bill was heard before the Senate Commerce Committee. We had heard testimony from nine witnesses in support of the bill. There was testimony in opposition from the Associated Oregon Industries, AOI. We were very fortunate then, as we are today, to have a national expert with us, that is Dr. Mamie, who is with the Workplace Bullying Institute. And I just want to thank him formally and publicly on the record for dropping everything and coming back to Oregon a second time to provide testimony in this hearing. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1035 makes harassment, intimidation, or bullying an unlawful employment practice. Violations of Senate Bill 1035 would allow for civil action, but not enforcement by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Current laws apply only to 25% of bullying cases. This measure closes legal loopholes in existing law. There is no fiscal impact to the measure, and no state regulatory function or department is involved. The legislation prohibits extreme abusive misconduct. Managers' rights are preserved. I would like to also share for the record that I received letters of support for this legislation from around the state, including Portland, Malala, Coos Bay, Corvallis. You do have before you a -1 amendment. Legislative Council, Mr. Cheek, is available to walk you through that if need be. At this point, I would like to stop and invite our national expert, Dr. Namie, to present testimony to you. And again, I thank him very much for being here today.
Thank you, and thank you, Dr. Namie, for joining us.
Oh, it's the pleasure's mine. And I thank Senator Gordley for being the champion of this bill. It's a bill whose time has come, many would say. In the family of potentially traumatizing episodes in our lives, we've said no to child abuse. We've said no to domestic violence, and that took 3/4 of a century. We've said no to school bullying after years and years and years of saying, well, it's a rite of passage and it was normalized. And we finally said no to that. In the workplace, we say no to workplace violence, physical battery, and homicide. They're costly, divisive, disruptive to employers, and employers care very much about it. But that leaves a huge gap in the fact that in the workplace we don't pay attention to the psychological aspects. And I might say, when I say we, I mean we in America, American employers. The U.S. is the last of the industrialized nations to consider this type of legislation. So you have to know that we're way behind the curve on this. The first international law was passed in 94 in Sweden, and virtually every country has some form of this type of legislation. In Canada, Quebec is the only province that has a law, a statutory law, but as I just came back from Vancouver speaking on Monday again to a huge safety group, the way that each Canadian province is dealing with workplace bullying is to consider it occupational safety and health hazard, and therefore they're addressing it through regulatory reform. In the U.S., nothing. It's just the absence of acknowledgement of it. But when I speak to so many HR groups and HR professionals, they all know what a big problem it is. So let me give you a quick, I'll do a quick teach, and then I'm going to compliment the bill on and point out a couple features of the bill, and then I can answer any questions you have. The prevalence of bullying, the best study we have in terms of a scientific representative sample is 1 in 6, 16%. But a very significant survey was just done this past March, and I was on CNBC this morning for the third time in a month talking about workplace bullying, and the author of that poll, in which they found 45% of folks in their work life had been exposed to an abusive boss. So this was an employer group commissioned survey. And furthermore, 64% of the respondents in that survey said there ought to be a way to address this legally. Why is this so invisible in the eyes of the law? So it's somewhere between 16 and 40%. Let's just say that. Bullying has to be defined, though. It really cannot be considered just trivial, an occasional awkward glance. It can't be some insignificant innuendo or teasing or any of those other things. It really needs to be defined as significant. Bullying needs to be significant health-harming types of mistreatment. It is three times more prevalent than the illegal forms of harassment. And here's the stunner. The reference of the discussion of the prior bill, obviously several are lawyers among you. It is amazing that so many lawmakers don't understand that much harassment is not illegal. It requires the recipient be a member of a protected status group, but you are unfortunately out of luck mostly if you experience same sex or same race harassment. That's the great unknown. And so 50% of bullying is woman on woman, and therefore they are stuck. It's the devil's wear Prada kind of a phenomenon. Well, in particular, this kind of woman on woman cruelty, as women seem to acknowledge quicker than men, is not addressable by any law. So the point is, what does the individual who goes through it do? Well, they're told to grow a thicker skin. In fact, all the rationalizations are akin to domestic violence. The same things that battered spouses were told. Well, if it's so bad, just leave. Tell that to a single mom, the only wage earner in a household. How is she going to, quote, just leave? Well, it's an employment at will situation. Well, it's more like employment at whim if you're suffering at the hands of either a bully boss, and a bully is a boss 7 out of 10 cases. But don't forget coworkers. Coworkers can be tyrannical too and problematic. And fortunately, the amendment allows that in there, puts that in there. So, nevertheless, what you have is potential health harm, stress-related physical and psychological health harm. And just, I've given you the handout, and you can read it, and you can study it, you can go to the websites, and all that extra time I'm sure you don't have. I've seen your workload today, and I admire what you're trying to accomplish. But truthfully, to have 30% of women who experience this suffer post-traumatic stress disorder is unconscionable in the American workplace. Where should it be written for that paycheck that you should sustain a war wound? That level of emotional harm is there. For crying out loud, the Turkish Supreme Court acknowledged that bullying, a.k.a. mobbing, as the Europeans call it, is grounds for causing harm. There's a whole host of brand new research showing that In the just this year, the fact that the studying physical torture and psychological harassment, psychological torture, the effects of the traumatizing effects of the psychological mistreatment and ill treatment are as great as physical torture. And this is what some people in the extreme go through. So therefore, how do we address it? Well, employers should care very much. I wear many hats, and one of them is I'm a consultant, international consultant, and we go primarily to Canadian firms that ask us to take care of bullying because it impacts their turnover, their absenteeism, their health care utilization, workers' comp, disability. It's too expensive for good employers to sustain. Good employers know how to stop bullying. So what we're dealing with are the indifferent or the bad employers who choose to compel the target, we don't call them victims, the targets to fend for themselves and to fix their own problem as if they were the cause of it. And yet this is a unilaterally determined systematic campaign of interpersonal destruction on the worker, and you can't ask him or her, and 80% of the time it's a she, to resolve it by him or herself. So if the employer doesn't want to look after their own best self-interest, maybe we should follow what happens in terms of sexual harassment. Employers, after all, do not voluntarily say, I think women are mistreated here. We need to have a law. In response to state and federal laws, policies are created to be in compliance. So the model in the American workplace is clearly until employers are prodded by the threat of potential litigation. In this case, brought only by private action, this bill engages no state agency, no fiscal impact, no regulatory role. In other words, you're going to have to convince a plaintiff's attorney that you have a case with merit and then convince a judge that it'll survive summary judgment. That if your case has merit, then you can go and bring legal action. Now, here's what's beautiful about SB 1035. It's a pro-employer anti-bullying bill. Because if you look at the amendments in this, you call it dash one, section 4 provides for generous affirmative defense. Good employers who have basically already created a policy and faithfully enforce it, and they have, as it says here, have exercised reasonable care, 4A, reasonable care to prevent or correct this behavior, will not be eligible for vicarious liability claims. The bully can be hung out to dry. The aggressive individual, as named up in the first line of the amendment that says employer or coworker could be held, accountable, but the employer would be very safe if they've taken care to prevent and correct. So therefore, the real goal of the legislation is to compel employers to do something that enlightened employers do naturally, but this is just a prod to sort of bring us in line with an enlightened point of view. Secondarily, it does plug the gap in the existing laws, the state and federal civil rights statutes that allows for unconscionable harassment between same-sex and same-gender pairs.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Naimi. Questions? Senator Johnson.
A couple. I'm curious to know whether or not businesses in the audience today or whether any of the business organizations have opined with respect to the language. And I don't know if they're planning to testify or if you, Senator Gordley, know there are some in the audience.
I don't know. The only thing I can tell you, Senator Johnson, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, is that at the previous hearing before the Commerce Committee, we did hear negative testimony or testimony in opposition from AOI.
And just to answer your question, there's no one else signed up besides Mr. We're going to bring Mr. Cheek up to have him do a quickie walkthrough on the amendments. But if there are folks that do want to testify, we'll certainly let them do that. Senator Johnson.
My other question, I guess, is to define what the reasonable standard is on line one of page two. Harassment, intimidation, or bullying includes but is not limited to derogatory remarks, insults, epithets, physical conduct that a reasonable person would find threatening, intimidating, or humiliating. I'm just trying to find where that line is between someone with acute sensitivities who might take offense at anything and potential risk to an employer with respect to finding that reasonable line.
Senator Johnson, as I understand it from the original draft of the original text of the bill, the reasonable was the reasonableness of the jury, I guess. Whatever the reasonable person test is legalistically. In terms of common street credibility, there seems to be a fairly clear agreement what that which is inappropriately intimidating or harmful or harassing or humiliating, offensive, and the rest. There seems to be, it's fairly easy to get some consensus on that. But admittedly, some of the other versions of the bill, there are 27 versions of this bill that have been introduced in 12 states. Oregon stands at this point to be the first state to move the legislation forward now if it were to become law.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I guess that begs the question, why? 27 versions introduced in 12 states and nobody's moved it forward.
Because the American way of management seems to be that the sort of an unrestricted managerial prerogative. When I give testimony, there is invariably a Chamber of Commerce representative sitting right there saying, don't regulate me and don't make me do this because my managers have to have protections. Even though we provide protection for managerial prerogative, the ability to appropriately and to criticize and discipline employees, but it seems that American businesses want the right to be abusive, to conduct business. At some point, that needs to be challenged on the face of it. But in many, many chambers and state legislatures, the sentiment is whatever business wants, business gets. And the employee health issue is rendered secondary. But as we heard in the Commerce Committee, the testimony is quite compelling when we bring the people forward.
Madam Chair, we heard testimony, as I said earlier, from 9 witnesses, inclusive of Dr. Namy and the Commerce Committee. And what struck me was that these were witnesses who had endured bullying in the workplace, and they were still living with the results of psychological damage and also health issues. The other thing that I want to point out is that of the 27 versions in the 12 states, would want you to be aware of those states in addition to Oregon, Connecticut, Washington, New York, New Jersey, Oklahoma, Montana, Hawaii. All of the states I just named have active legislation. That means they're still in the process of making decisions. Kansas, Missouri, Massachusetts, California have all considered some form of this legislation as well. I also want to put on record that this bill did not move forward in the Commerce Committee because we ran out of time to get a amendment completed, and that had nothing to do with legislative counsel. We just ran out of time in the committee. I'm asking today that you move the bill into work session and that we bring this to the floor and hopefully have a good and healthy debate there about the place of workplace bullying as a unlawful employment practice and as good public policy for the state of Oregon.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, one other question. You talked about employees and behavior between and among employees. And again, I'm looking at the language and trying to figure out what the standard would be, gratuitous sabotage or undermining of an employee's work performance. Frankly, I'm thinking about this building and the behaviors that go on in this building. And I'm trying to think and project ahead to the potential for frivolous lawsuit. I agree with the basic premise of the bill, but it is the looseness of the language that is a little bit worrisome to me. I think there are some that would submit that Oregon is not the most business-friendly place in the country. And my concern is if I'm an employer and I have a highly competitive workforce and working under tremendous pressure on a variety of projects, and I have two employees competing to move ahead, what's the definition of gratuitous sabotage or undermining another one's work performance? I mean, how does this place not just erupt in lawsuits if this were passed? This place is just a hive of villainy, and I'm trying to figure out how we avoid being mired in endless, expensive litigation if we don't have a little tighter sideboards on this.
Senator Johnson, I'm fairly sure that the check and balance that would have to be put in place in terms of the frivolous complaint thing, unless you have added a component as an amendment at this stage, it's probably going to have to be, is there enough, is there sufficient grounds to raise the case? Can you interest an attorney in even taking it? And will a judge let it pass the smell test to get through, you know, summary judgment? And cases are notorious for being dismissed at the summary judgment level. The three categories of misconduct that we use to define bullying are verbal abuse, conduct that's intimidating, threatening, humiliating, and the sabotage is always the third one. The first two categories can cause the third, or the third can stand alone. We're talking about actually the prevention of getting work done, because one of the mythologies out there is these tough guys and gals as bosses drive people, motivate them, and they are responsible for generating results and productivity. In reality, they actually undermine legitimate business interests.
Thank you. Mr. Cheek, amendments. Could you please tell us?
Discuss what they do.
Yep.
Yes, Chair Brown, members of the committee. The Dash 1 amendments do a couple of things for the bill. First of all, they add in subsection 3 on page 2 retaliation as also part of the unlawful employment practice related to workplace bullying. In other words, if someone complains or files a legal action in relationship to a claim about workplace bullying, they may not be retaliated against by the employers or coworkers because they have taken that action, and that retaliation is also considered an unlawful employment practice. The second thing, and it spells out the criteria for that, what that includes. It also includes participating in an investigation of a claim of bullying as well. The second major thing that the Dash 1s do is it establishes the affirmative defense that has already been discussed in relationship to the employer, providing that if the employer has exercised reasonable care to prevent or promptly correct actionable behavior, the employer is protected from liability. And if the also provides that if the employee filing a complaint or pursuing legal action has failed to take advantage of an appropriate preventative or corrective opportunity provided by the employer to deal with workplace issues, perhaps through a human resource department or some other process, that also provides the affirmative defense for the employer. The final thing that the Dash 1 amendments do is clarifies what types of damages would be available, adding that this particular unlawful employment practice to existing statutes would provide for compensatory damages and for violation for actual proof of the unlawful employment practice.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions? Sir Johnson.
One last one. I'm trying to, again, go back to the scenario where you have two highly competitive employees, and the employer tries to separate them and tries to put somebody one place and somebody someplace. What are the degrees that would define reasonable accommodation? I just have two people that are highly valued employees that hate each other. That's disruptive in the normal activities of running a business, but to what degree is under this bill, would the employer have to what defines reasonable accommodation your language here is promptly correct any actionable behavior. What are the lengths that I have to go to correct?
Clearly, Senator Johnson, that's up to the employer. And the reasonableness is going to be, for me, the reasonableness is whether there's been a restoration of safety, employee safety.
Because how do you define that?
Yeah, this is a that's where it becomes interpretable almost only on a case-by-case basis. I think,
And I guess Senator Johnson, and I don't do this kind of law. I think at this point I'd like to. I was going to move into work session, but I think what I want to do. Some of our colleagues have done employment law that serve in the Senate, and I would like to talk with them before we move forward on this legislation. But in the circumstance you just described, I don't know who would sue if you've got two employees who are not getting along. Who's able to sue each other? I just. I don't expect a reasonable lawyer to take any of those cases. Lord knows that there's a lot of unreasonable lawyers out there.
But perish the thought.
I know, but I think there's I think you've got to have some level of threshold before plaintiff's lawyers would be willing to take a case like that you just described. But I don't do this kind of work, so.
I just want to just say, for the purpose of moving ahead with this, I'm not unsympathetic. I just want to make sure that we know precisely what the language does, because I just don't want to lay employers open to gratuitous lawsuits and make employment relations more difficult rather than trying to fix something. So I'm not unsympathetic to the issue. I would just like a little more clarity.
Chair
I appreciate
Brown,
that.
May I ask a procedural question? Because I don't know anything about this. Is it too late to add precision?
Certainly not.
Because we have language that will exactly provide this, and it's a threshold of health harm.
Okay.
When you make a health harm threshold, it is a very, very high standard.
Okay.
And that will eliminate most of the, all of the frivolous stuff, actually.
Okay. And we also, just so you know, our rules of civil procedure have motions, I think it's ORCP 17, that limit, that provide for payment of lawyers' fees and the filing of frivolous lawsuits. So we do have
that could be
legislation
tapping.
To, but let's take a look at this. We will be meeting committee next week twice because no one has anything to do, and we've got a number of things that we're going to need to move. So let's take a couple of days, talk to our colleagues, and see if we can't get some more precision
thank
under the language.
Much.
So, all right. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on 1035, knowing that it'll come back next week for public hearing? Thank you. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1035. I'm going to go on up to, I know we've got folks that have some time commitments. I've got some other folks here. I'd like to open a public hearing on the Tourism Commission. We've got the dynamic duo of Jackie Edmonds-Manns and Wynn McCormick. If you would both come forward, and we can grill you appropriately and then get you on your way. Hello and welcome, and thanks for your patience, and I hope you're enjoying this interesting process that we have.
The legislative process.
Indeed. Indeed. So if you would tell us a little bit about yourselves and why you want to serve on this fabulous commission that we would all die to serve on, but we can't because we're in the Oregon legislature. That would be great.
Where do you want to start? You want to start?
I'll start. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jackie Edmonds-Manns, and why I would like to serve on this committee. I chose Oregon. I am not a native Oregonian. I was living in Spain and chose. Yes, yeah. I know people do that. I get the eye roll. What? But I did choose to come to Oregon. I feel passionately about my chosen home state and am delighted with everything that's going on here. I'm very excited about the tourism industry. I think the state has a tremendous amount to offer, and I would like to use my marketing background and my background in the hospitality business. I am not currently in the hospitality business, and in fact am being considered as an at-large for this committee to help promote Oregon. I have some what I hope are wonderful ideas and have heard some terrific things about the strategic plan and would like to be a part of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McCormick.
Yes, ma'am. My name is Gwynne McCormick. I'm a publisher, magazine publisher, and book publisher, and editor by profession. I've been in Oregon since 1970 when I came here to study for a degree at the OVO in fine arts, a Master of Fine Arts degree, where I also taught for 2 years. From 1976 to 1988, I published a magazine called Oregon Magazine. And in that magazine, tourism was one of our main subjects and one of our main sources of advertising, along with restaurant advertising. It was then that I first conceived the idea that the state should have a tourism magazine to promote itself. I was familiar with Arizona Highways and a publication annual that the state of Washington did, a guide to tourist infrastructure in Washington. And I started proposing this idea to the state in the early 80s and did that through Oregon Magazine and then later through another company I'm involved in called Media America, which in the early part of this new century finally got the contract to do it. And we published this publication called Travel Oregon twice a year, which I think has been, as I envisioned it, very successful in promoting the industry. Why I'm interested? My original interest is because economic development in the state of Oregon has long been one of my main concerns. And I found out you could not get on the Economic Development Commission unless you're a professional politician or a professional in the field. And the only other thing was tourism, which is one of our major industries. And at the time I first got interested, I thought was very underfunded and very underutilized, the Oregon Tourism Bureau. And as I understand it, as a result of the lodging tax, our budget has gone from number 47th among states in the country to number 28. But I think there's still more to be done, and I'd like to be part of it.
Senator Johnson, before you do that, I just want to put on for the record, Mr. McCormick is filling the statutory appointment for a member, one of three members from travel agencies, tour operators, private transportation, restaurants, or other organizations engaged in tourism promotion. And Ms. Edmonds-Manns is filling the public member at large. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'm always happy for correction. I maybe misunderstood you with respect to service on the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission. Is that what you were talking about, that that's somehow reserved to?
Well, that's what I gleaned from talking to Kate and also from reading the blue book.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
That is certainly not my understanding, and I would hope that, assuming that you're confirmed, and I wouldn't see any reason why you wouldn't be, I think we're lucky to have you, I would hope that your interest in economic development would continue for possible appointment there as well. The reason I say that is I serve as an ex officio at the pleasure of the Senate President on that board and have had the opportunity to review both in this context and service there the credentials of the current folks that are serving, and they are certainly not all tourism, economic development professionals, nor persons serving in elected public life. So,
I stand corrected. When I looked at the book,
I think the issue, frankly, Mr. McCormick, was a conflict of interest issue that the governor's office raised to me, which is my recollection of the conversation, but I don't think that's...
Oh, because of the publishing activities. Oh. Let's focus on this confirmation.
On
you're going to be a
one.
Wonderful right. addition.
I'm sure Mr. Cormick and I can settle this later another evening over cocktails somewhere in southeast Portland. So, Ms. Manns-Edmonds, I wanted to get back to you in terms of Spain, and I just wanted to point out, I think it's very interesting that you would move here from Spain. I was actually born outside of Madrid and only spent a very short period of time of my life there and hoping to actually get to go back, but I do think it's interesting that you would choose to come here to Portland. I'm just really glad you chose us, so because I'm also a chosen a convert to Oregon as well. So
thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Senator Montes-Anderson.
I think it's interesting what your email address is because tourism is, you know, eye-catching, in to sell Oregon, and the fact that you are Big Mac to go.
It's great. Senator Nelson. Nelson?
I'm good.
No interesting or unusual comments?
Can't
okay.
top any of this.
Well, I think you've wowed the committee. Anything else either one of you would like to, any comments you'd like to make?
Well, even if Senator Nelson doesn't have anything he wants to ask, I understand you're from Pendleton.
That's right.
And I'm also on the Oregon Council for the Humanities, and as you know, we're very active in Pendleton.
Done a great job with the prison and the community. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you. And I also see part of your role is helping us bring urban and rural Oregon together. And I know that both of you live in the metro area and will work hard to overcome your urban biases to make sure that all of Oregon is promoted in our tourism.
Well, it would be hard to promote Oregon tourism without doing that.
Good.
Looking forward to seeing the rest of the state of Oregon and learning more about it.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us. Travel safely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Members of the committee.
Oh, and I did want to point out, I'm bilingual. So she's bilingual. So we'll add another. So, all right. Anybody else wishing to testify on the commission, the Tourism Commission? Seeing as everybody's leaving the room on that one, I'm going to close the public hearing. We want to go back up to, did we lose Senator Trow?
No, he's reconnected.
Okay. We got to get these guys on. Okay. Why don't we open up a public hearing on SJM 9 and SJM 11. I believe, colleagues, both of you, all of you know that these are what are fondly known as gut and stuffs. And
not the witnesses, Madam the Bill.
Right? Here we are. Well, we're both Navy
workers. I'm going to start them. We'll see. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us a little bit about these bills and then these guys.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, SJM 9 and SJM 11 have amendments, and each one has the dash one amendment. On SJM 9, the dash one amendment just comments on the value of the training and transition of the National Guard and urges the Congress to pass legislation to approve funds for a transition for the National Guard and reservists to civilian life following their active service. And SJM 11, again, the dash one amendment replaces the memorial and comments on the rights of states to maintain an organized militia for the protection and defense of citizens and comments on the state control of the National Guard during emergencies.
Okay, welcome, and please introduce yourself and start with SJM 9.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director at the Military Department.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Evans. I work for the governor.
SJM 9 is basically pretty straightforward in what we're attempting to, I guess, get this, body to go along with, is memorialized to the Congress of the United States that when we have folks that are deployed and they come back, and in this state we've had over, let's say, right around 7,000 separate mobilizations if you do it individually, that the Congress recognized that there's a transition period coming back into real life. These are citizen soldiers, and to give you the best example I can give you is that Oregon has stepped up in the last session and formed a transition team, a reintegration team, which has been very successful with our folks. Yet half of that team, or 50% of the funding of that team, is state funding, not federal. And we re-engineered other federal funds to try to make this this operation successful, and it has been. It's a model in the country. United States, all throughout the country, all National Guard states are copying what we're doing here in Oregon to help these soldiers transition back into civilian life. What this memorial does, I think, is keep it on the front burner in front of Congress to continue to push for funding to keep these reintegration programs up and running, not only here but throughout the country. I think that will benefit these soldiers as they reintegrate back into their civilian worlds with their workplace, their neighbors, their families, and everybody else. So it's pretty straightforward, pretty simple, and that's really what this does.
Sarah Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, General. By the orderly transition language here, I would presume that this would be across all spectrums. It would provide counseling if necessary. Does it contemplate health care for wounded soldiers as well?
Yes, Senator, it does.
That's the piece that I wanted to make sure, because I think it's just shameful that we are making people that have worn the uniform of this country and have been promised and have earned benefits, make them beg for those benefits. And I couldn't be more supportive of anything that continues to indicate, I think, our national desire to have these people have access to the very best of everything, not have to beg, and as we saw in that horrendous Walter Reed situation, be subjected to the very worst.
Madam Chair, if I could add on to that. One of the general's been very shy to talk about, which is uncharacteristic, as you know, but very shy, because Oregon really is the leader in the country right now. In fact, there are only 10 states that have reintegration programs.
Good.
43 states and territories don't have it. And the problem that we want to emphasize and need your help on is, number one, as the general talked about, keeping this in the discussion and making sure Congress understands that we're pushing forward. But the other piece is trying to make sure that we put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Because the reintegration piece is not just to take care of veterans when they come home and their families, which is important, but it's also to reset the force and make sure that we can use them again as we need them to protect ourselves during domestic as well as foreign mm-hmm. crisis. And Oregon is leading the way. There's some things that we need help from Congress, and the legislature is a vital partner in doing that.
I would just, I guess, cap it off by saying that the Oregon delegation, our seven members of Congress, have been extremely supportive. They've been extremely aggressive. They've been doing across the board, trying to get as much as they can through different pieces of legislation at that level to help this program along even more so. It was almost criminal in my mind here 3 years ago when we were actually started 3 years ago, our program, and we were pushing Congress to do that. Our members were trying to get some things in. They weren't in the right position. And at the end of the day, they added $1 million into the defense budget to study the reintegration of Guard and Reserve troops. And over 50% of the troops that were on the ground in Iraq were Guard and Reserve. It was just pathetic. I mean, it was just that pathetic. I don't know who got the study. I never saw the study. You would think that they would have published something after $1 million on it, but somebody did a study, and yet the rubber meeting the road has to be done at this level. And so this keeps this on the radar screen and pushes it up there, and we really believe that it's important that we keep it in their screen, keep it in front of them.
Madam Chair, if you're looking for a motion, I've got one.
Hang on just a second. Senator Nelson.
Okay. We were working with the general on doing this for the Pendleton and LeGrand units.
Right.
And we've created a partnership. I guess you've created a partnership with Pendleton Academies.
Right. Yes, sir.
And they're a multi-treatment youth group out there. Mm. Who bring psychiatrists from Portland, fly them in every week. And so they're going to work together to help some of the soldiers or families or whatever they do. And I was trying to get $30,000 in our public safety committee for that. And I think
that's
I'm
all
working
you
on
want,
it.
Sarah Nelson?
Well, that's all that we can probably get. How much more can we get out? that was a policy package, actually, that the general had.
Okay.
So we felt that was reasonable, and at least a start. But it's a good,
yeah,
good part
of it. I guess for further information, what we know now, and thanks to Congress doing some of these things, our soldiers are eligible for TRICARE, which is a managed health care system that the federal government uses, Pentagon uses for all members of the force. And up until October this year, in October, every member of the Guard and the Reserve will be eligible to purchase that even if they're not mobilized. Once they're mobilized, they get it while their families get it while they're there, and then they get it for 6 months post-deployment. And so what we're hoping, now that these families can sign up on TRICARE, even though the payments are bad, that we'll be able to help add on to that when they go in and get mental health care. So whatever TRICARE pays, which is usually about the Medicare, Medicaid rate, considerably less than what the provider pays, we can use some of that money to keep that program alive and keep that service available to those people, particularly in the rural area. It's really difficult to find that kind of service in the rural Oregon areas.
Senator Miles Anderson.
Yes. My very first patient, Paul, I think, has heard this story. My very first patient as a nurse was a home visit to a Vietnam vet, and I'd always seen him walking the streets and going through garbage cans, et cetera. And this was in the early 80s, so he'd been out for about 10 years, but he was just sort of a fixture in Blacksburg, Virginia, where I was living. And it was just a few houses down
or actually a few blocks away from where I lived, and he had post-traumatic stress syndrome, and he had infections, actually maggots in his feet that were not cared for, but he had slipped through the cracks, and he needed mental health care. And thank goodness there were some concerned neighbors that said, hey, someone needs to go in and see and help this guy. And we got him into the VA, and the stories I heard is he just needed to have some care, and he was doing fine.
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Anderson, we had testimony in, I can't recall now, we've had several hearings on this before different committees, and also Senator Wyden and Representative Hooley had their own public hearings on these very subjects. One of the providers in the Veterans Hospital in Portland indicated that he had an 87 or 88-year-old World War II veteran who somebody realized things weren't going well in his life, and they finally got him into VA, and he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder from World War II. And so there's no clock on this stuff. There is no certainty of if or when or what the result may be. So unfortunately, it takes this kind of a horrific incidents that are occurring worldwide and all the news to get anybody interested in it. But here's a gentleman who served in World War II 60 years ago.
Yeah. And the point is that if you can get him back and get him into normal life in a rational way, you can hopefully avoid long-term costs to both the person, their family, and society as a whole.
Right.
So that the emphasis of the reintegration program is trying to get them within the first 12 to 18 months to figure out what the problems are and start working those problems, instead of finding exactly these types of cases where even if people are trying hard, they still, if they don't have access early to diagnose that, then you've got a lifelong problem.
Mm-hmm. I would tell you that our reintegration program not only is it nationwide noted, but I think, based on anecdotal evidence, because it's hard to say who's going to need it, so you don't know whether you prevented it or not, but we know for a fact, based on anecdotal evidence that we've received from our guys that are working this program, is that we've gotten anywhere between 5 and 6 calls per week for over the last 2 years on these issues. And yet, there's only been a couple that have really manifested themselves into either a law violation, some situation where they're arrested and we pick them up in the jail. Latest one was 2 weeks ago. We had a young man who's been home over a year from Iraq, and he was over in Central Oregon. And one of our reintegration team members, and they were ready to take the SWAT team in and break the doors down and take him out. And because of different things that, you know, claims he'd made and weapons that he had. And our reintegration team member went over, called him up, sitting outside. Police are all getting ready to raid. And he said, I need you to come out and talk to me. He said, I'll talk to you. So he went in and got him, and he's now with the VA. We got him in the VA and voided a jail sentence, voided a court trial. Police stood down. You know, everybody went back to normal. We got him into where he needed the help. And he was really suffering from PTSD. And when he told him it was the guard, the locals over in Bend said, the guard. So they called the guard. The guard called the reintegration guy. He jumped in the car and drove to Bend. And that's how we've been dealing with these onesies and twosies. And we've probably had close to a dozen of those very similar incidents in the last 3 years. But our guys work 24/7. If they call in the middle of the night, they're going to get up and go. So they'll take care of it, and we'll go where we have to go to get these people. So.
All right. Do we want to move on to SJM 11?
Okay.
Start on that one.
And then we'll move both of these at the same time.
I'm still Paul Evans. I still work for Governor Kunkowski. Not a lawyer, but I was born in Oregon. Senate Joint Memorial 11, as was termed, is a gut and stuff. And what we need with this one, quite frankly, is this is a truly important memorial that this legislature needs to send forward at this specific time. What it does is it asks the Congress and the President to rethink a decision that made in 2006 having to do with the Insurrection Act. Context on this is that the U.S. House of Representatives just yesterday passed what we're trying to get the Congress to pass in whole. So it still has the Senate, it still has a presidential signature before it changes back to the way it should be. Basically, in 2006, and the General will explain in detail as we go on, but in 2006, a piece of legislation usurped the power of the governor, and what it does is it takes away power from a governor to use the National Guard during times of crisis when they actually need to use the National Guard. So what this does is really two things. One, it tries to ask the Congress to go back, rethink a decision, and two, it also says that as a legislature, there is a role for the governor and the National Guard in times of disaster and crisis. How this relates to timeliness is, if you look at what happened in Kansas recently, depending on perspective, there were not enough assets in place for the governor to respond as quickly as one would like. Now, that actually enters into a larger conversation about resetting the National Guard, and it talks about how the National Guard is about 50% equipment and staffing nationwide. But in this particular context, this specific memorial asked the Congress to go back and rethink the governor's authority over the state national militia, the state militia, during times of crisis. And that's why we need this done, to make sure that they understand clearly that the states are united, the governor's united, and that the dual role of the National Guard is special enough to warrant the governor having authorities during times of crisis.
Before you, Mr. Evans, I just want to make sure this is not a partisan issue. Is that correct? My understanding.
National Guard Association.
Unanimously?
Unanimously. The states, actually, and the vote in the Congress was not a by-party line either. I don't know the numbers, but it was not just a DR split.
Thank you. Brigadier General.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Paul pretty well outlined the situation. We believe that the Insurrection Act was completely, had all of the necessary tools in it for the president to utilize it if it was so deemed necessary. What happened in this particular last-minute change in the defense bill last year was basically remove all the bars. There's no hurdles. There's no tests. There's no nothing. It's basically that the president of the United States determines that the governor is incapable of doing the governor's constitutional role, and so they usurp his authority, his or her authority, and put the National Guard under federal control with no test. We were shocked when it came out. We were stunned, the National Guard community nationwide. The governor's association railed against it, both parties. It was just simply a real surprise, and it really stemmed from the situation that occurred in Louisiana and the dispute between the governor of Louisiana and the president. We just firmly believe that constitutionally it's clear that the governor is the commander-in-chief in the guard until such time as the Constitution allows the president to call up the guard for federal service. And it works well now. This was unnecessary. It was reaching. It was over the top. And we really do support this. And I have no knowledge of any governor and or any state that doesn't.
Right.
So last I heard, there was none. And even Florida was upset last year over this thing. And there was a letter that came from one sibling to another telling him that he thought he overreached. So that ought to pretty well set the stage.
All right. Thank you. Anybody else? Any other comments? All right. Thank you, both of you. Thanks for your leadership. Thanks for your service, and appreciate your hard work on these issues. I'm going to close the public hearing, move into work session on SJM 9 and SJM 11. I did want to thank Senator Gordley for allowing us to use a vehicle of hers, and that's it. Senator Johnson, did you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I would move the -1 amendments into SJM 9.
Senator Johnson has moved the -1 amendments to SJM 9. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I would move SJM 9 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Senator Johnson has moved SJM 9 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation to the Senate floor. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. SJM 11.
Madam Chair, I would move the -1 amendments to SJM 11.
Senator Johnson moves the -1 amendments to SJM 11. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I would move amended SJM 11 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Johnson has moved SJM 11 as amended Senate floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Want to carry 9?
Sure.
Want to carry 11?
I mean, yes,
okay?
Madam Chair.
Okay.
All right. All right. Let's get Senator Troll up here. Let's close the work session. Open public hearing on the library board. Senator Troll, I'm so sorry to keep you waiting.
Well, that's okay.
It is very good to see you.
It was fun to listen to you guys deliberate.
I'm sure it is.
I'm Cliff Troll from Corvallis. Been appointed to the state... the trustee, to be a trustee of the State Library Board, and so I'm delighted to see you all, Senator Brown and all the other senators, and also Marjorie, who I work with at the legislature. So, great to be here.
Senator Trill, my recollection is we placed a former constituent of yours, was former mayor of ours, we put him on another board. Thus leaving this hole here. So we're very glad you're willing. Is there a reason why you particularly serve on the State Library Board of Trustees?
Well, I like libraries, for one thing, and I like the State Library, and I remember it well from my legislative service, being on the Ways and Means Committee and watching it do its job from the vantage point of oversight. And so it'll be good to be there. I like libraries in general, and I've been serving in Corvallis on the Corvallis Benton County Public Library Board of Advisors, and did that for 8 years. So that was fun. I was chair for a brief time, and that was a good experience. I think you learn a lot about libraries. Also, I think you see the need for library service over the state, and I think we're fortunate in Corvallis to have a very good library, and there are very good libraries elsewhere in the state, no question about it, but there are areas where we don't have good library service. And so about, 9% of the people of Oregon do not have access to a free public library. And so the State Library is about the business of trying to help alleviate that problem and has been for its entire history. So it's fun to be part of something that I think is very important. Senator Brown, perhaps you and I both spent a lot of time in Norland Library at the University of Colorado.
I was just looking at that, Senator Troll. I forgot that connection.
Yeah, that library was very instrumental in helping me get a doctoral degree, and I certainly appreciated that help. And so I like libraries.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
If there was ever a time when libraries needed a good friend and an advocate, it's now. I think we are seeing in the newspaper, and I know that I have a library district, a brand new library, a gorgeous library.
Hey, I want to see it.
Hanging by, well, you better hurry. It's hanging by a thread for a vote of the people. And I just think having someone of Senator Trow's formidable advocacy skills and statewide reputation being out publicly as a friend to libraries and closely associated in this capacity as a friend of libraries can be nothing but a boon to all of us who are hanging on to little libraries. I mean, the first opportunity for kids to go in and hold a book for many of them. And I just think this is an inspired appointment, and I hope he's out riding the circuit preaching the gospel of libraries throughout Oregon.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I remember how well your mother preached the gospel of public schools and higher education to the state, too. So I'll be glad to try to do that as best I can. Just a word about Charlie Vars. His wife, Frida, was a very good member of the Corvallis Public Library Board, and then has been on the State Library Board for the last 8 years. And she leaves big footprints for me to be involved with, because she has done a very good job.
Senator Trow, I'm sure she will also keep you in line in case you step out of line anywhere along the road.
Right.
I also was concerned that in your busy schedule that you have sufficient time to spend on this issue, but it sounds like you'll be able to make time.
It will be fun to do that.
Great. Senator Nelson?
It seems that I'm seeing in my part of the country there's a lot of telecommunications going to the library. I mean, it's really giving us a lot of access.
Right. Oh, boy.
And so I just want to, you know, to continue to advocate for that.
Yeah, and I think you're so right, and it's the future, and we have to make sure that libraries keep keep in tune with what's happening and be as up-to-date as they can. I know even with the Talking Books and Braille Service part of the State Library, there's a massive change to digital talking books, and that takes a lot of staff training. It takes a lot of training of the blind folks to use those, but it's a tremendous advantage.
Thank you for your good service.
You're welcome.
As well as meeting the needs of those who are at home. I mean, we have a lot of mobile units coming out from the libraries also, so they have a very important role in our community for the complete age span.
Another challenge, I think, for the State Library is the fact that although it provides these services for a good many people, over 7,000 people, I think, take advantage of them, there are about 50,000 people out there who are eligible that don't take advantage. So there's a challenge, and there's lots to do on the State Library. And I like the fact that they get out and they go around the state. And if they haven't been over to visit Senator Johnson's library, we ought to get over there.
Tillamook.
All right. Okay.
That'd be great.
Very good.
Thank you, Senator Troy. Will you give our best to your lovely wife? I hope she's doing
well.
I'll
do that. And thank you all for the great job you're doing.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good to see you. Okay, let's see, close the public hearing. Let's open a public hearing on housing. Francisco Lopez. And last but not least, Kim Duncan. Hello, how are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Francisco Lopez, and I'm a resident of South Salem. I'm originally from El Salvador, a small country in Central America, and yesterday actually was 22 years ago that I came to this country. I'm a Salvadoran American now. I'm the director of support services program for adults with developmental disabilities. So I work in 8 counties, and I'm proud to serve 650 adults with developmental disabilities. I've been involved in issues related to affordable housing since 1998 when I moved here to Oregon from Texas, and I've been working there ever since. Why I'm interested in this position, as I mentioned, I think when I came here to Oregon, I saw the deplorable conditions that many farm workers live, and the housing part, I was part of these advocacy efforts that later on resulted in the creation of farm worker housing tax credit and many other areas. I think that was the same year, 1999, that the legislature allocated some funds for affordable housing for farm workers. More lately, I've been involved with working with Oregon Housing and Community Services on advocating for affordable housing for adults with developmental disabilities in several counties. And I know many of you have probably received visits of adults with developmental disabilities that I work and I serve with, and which we are looking into that area. So my interest also is a person that got his first home here in Oregon, and I remember the big struggles and the roadblocks, but that's my interest on that.
Thank you. And Mr. Lopez, we really appreciate your willingness, given I know that you have a very busy work schedule to do this. I also think it's critically important with the changing face of Oregon that we have bilingual, multicultural folks serving on this particular board. So it's actually a council. So
thank you.
Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, I am very hopeful with this appointment and the engagement of the Housing Council that you can help inform the legislature as we're looking at making a substantial investment in affordable housing. There's going to be a lot more need than we're going to have capacity to meet. And trying to figure out how we apportion the money that we hope to appropriate, whether it's to developmentally disabled communities, low-income working poor, seniors, all kinds of different housing pieces in the mix. I think we're going to rely on your council to help give guidance to this body so that we know that we're making targeted investments appropriately geographically and appropriate to the need, recognizing we're never going to have enough money to meet the full need.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I totally agree with you, and my work to going through different counties around the state, especially, you know, Columbia, Clatsop, Tillamook counties. I've seen the need, the shortage of affordable housing.
Yeah.
One of the great things that I'm working with currently with the director, Director Mercedes, is how do we look into affordable housing in a more holistic approach? Not just the roof, but the support services that need to be added and employment. In that regard, I'm working very close also with the Department of Human Services, and I think several adults with developmental disabilities and their families were instrumental in getting these two departments to talk to each other and coordinate efforts. And I'm proud to say that of a lot of those efforts, we were able to get the former director, Repine, and DHS to work more collaboratively in this and look at affordable housing again, more than just the roof, but the support services.
Boy, that's just music to my ears, because you might build a unit that would house 16 or 18 yes. developmentally disabled people. They don't need freestanding houses so much as they need integrated support services into maybe a little complex.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just to conclude my remark here, but to add that there was one person that I met when I started working in developmental disabilities, and that is from your district, Mr. Al Sonneker.
He was a wonderful man.
Yes, and one thing that I remember when I was talking about affordable housing, he said, Francisco, is more than just the roof. We need to make sure that we complement more support services for those that have affordable housing. And that stayed with me to this day, and I'm a strong advocate of those words of Mr. Sonneker was really a person that inspired me to do what I'm doing right now.
How nice of you to mention him.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think you've wowed us. Thank you very much for your time. I'm so sorry you had to wait so long. We just had a number of people on busy schedules. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on the State Housing Council, seeing no one else interested in testifying on that, and open
Maritime
Pilots. Ms. Duncan, welcome. And again, sorry taking so long, but we just had a lot of stuff going on today. So
sure did. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Actually, this was a wonderful afternoon.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, Ms. Duncan. You're welcome to come back anytime.
I was a little worried it wasn't going to be that interesting. I am from Portland, and I have been nominated as one of three public members on the State Board of Maritime Pilots. This board, I'm aware Senator Johnson's quite knowledgeable about, but this board has nine members. Three are pilots, three represent the shipping industry, and then there are three members from the public. You've been asking people why they're interested. Well, when this opportunity found me, I'll confess that I didn't know anything about this commission, and I spent some time trying to learn. And I have, and it's actually very interesting. This is, I believe, the oldest board in the state, and it was created in 1846, and it has existed in one form or another since then. So the importance of the work, I think, is clear from its historical perspective. The commission has had some high tides, some rough waters in recent months, and my interest comes, in fact, because of my background, where I hope that I can help during some transition issues that the commission will face. Should this legislature transfer the board from ODOT to the PUC, there'll be some changes in the way things are happen, and some new opportunities to address issues that were raised about it. And I'm hopeful that my long experience as a manager in marketing and government relations and communications and strategic planning will be beneficial there.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Duncan, Senator Johnson.
I am just giddy about this appointment. I mean, it would probably come as no surprise that a couple of the large pilotage grounds are in my district. And with the bar and the river pilot grounds, I am thrilled. The board has struggled in the past, and I think Ms. Duncan's expertise across a broad spectrum of issues is going to help stabilize the board, and I am just thrilled about this appointment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? I'm assuming, looking at the current state of your resume, that you had the adequate time to spend on this particular board.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. All right. I don't think we have anything else. We really appreciate you being so patient.
Thank you. As I said, it was worth it.
Nice Great. To see you again,
Kim.
Thank
you. I look forward to serving.
All right. With that, anybody else wishing to testify on the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots?
Seeing no volunteers, we're going to close the public hearing. Let's do some quickie work sessions. I'm going to open up a work session. I'm just going to buzz through these pretty quickly, folks, if that's okay. All right. Open a public hearing on the appointment of Francisco Lopez to the State Housing Council. Oops, I'm sorry. Opening a work session for the appointment of Francisco Lopez. And I would move the appointment of Francisco Lopez to the Senate floor with the recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Close the work session, open a work session, the appointment of Cliff Trowe to the trustees of the State Library and move that appointment to the Senate floor with the recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Close the work session, open a work session, the appointment of Kim Duncan to the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. And I would move that appointment to the floor with the recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Please note for the record that Senator Johnson is giddy about that particular appointment. Close the work session. Open a work session on the appointments of Robert Sconce and Michael Wood to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and I would move those appointments to the floor with the recommendation that the appointments be confirmed. Any discussion? These were two outstanding appointments. I'm very pleased they were willing to serve on the TSPC. Seeing no other discussion, any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Close the work session on the TSPC. Open a work session and on the appointments of Jackie Edmonds-Mans and Wynn McCormick to the Oregon Tourism Commission. And I would move those appointments to the Senate floor with the recommendation that they be confirmed. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Close the work session. These are the reappointments, folks, and we did not hear any of these appointments. I'd like to move forward on the reappointments unless there's any objection. Okay. I'm going to open work session for the consideration of reappointments to the following boards and commission: Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission, Home Care Commission, State Marine Board, Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots, Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators, State Board of Pharmacy, and Oregon Tourism Commission. And I would move the following reappointments to the Senate floor with the recommendation that they be confirmed: the reappointment of Judy Stigler to the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission, the reappointments of Sharon Ely, Kay Kirkbride, Scott Lay, and Michael Volk to the Home Care Commission, the reappointment of Trey Cascadarn and Deborah McQueen to the State Marine Board, the reappointment of Charles Yates to the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots, the reappointments of Ronald Gibson and Anita Shocker to the Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators, the reappointment of Lee Howard and Linda Howry to the State Board of Pharmacy, and we've got a slew of reappointments to the Oregon Tourism Commission: Jeffrey Comstan, Thomas Lewerson, Patrick Nofield, and Carrie Ann Westland. No relationship to the good senator. Okay. All right. Any discussion on those appointments, reappointments? Any objection to those reappointments? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Any other business to come before the committee? We need carriers. Who would be willing to carry the executive appointments?
I'll do it, Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson, I'll let you. We've got Johnson carrying 9, Nelson carrying 11. We'll bring back 1035 next week. Senate Bill 30 went to the good Senator Walker.
Westland.
Thank you. She would have killed me. I did want to point out for the record, I forgot to say, Mr. Wynn McCormick and his friend received a flat tire on their way here. Luckily, they were right near Woodburn and called the ODOT assistance, and ODOT helped them change their tire, so they were able to arrive here on time. I think they were actually early and enjoyed lunch in the lovely cafeteria downstairs. So good news story about ODOT as well. So anything else? Please travel safely. Have a fabulous weekend. I know no spa weekend for you, Senator Nelson. We'll all be in mourning. And it's going to be a tough week the next week. We have about 2 weeks left before we close down policy committees. This committee
stays open in June.
Stays open in June because we love you all.
I know it.
All right. With that, we're adjourned. Thanks, everybody.